cases showed the importance of the Gulf of Aden, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Red Sea for global trade, and the slightest incident affects the entire world and directly or indirectly involves many countries.
It's important to differentiate between what's happening between Israel and Hamas and what's happening in the Red Sea.
Given the high importance of the Bab el-Mandab Strait in global maritime trade for several decades, the world's major powers and countries on the strait's periphery have been trying to gain military dominance over this strategic waterway and have spent relatively large budgets to establish permanent or temporary military bases in this area.
We're witnessing one of the largest shifts in global geostrategic power that the world is witnessing.
Among foreign countries competing in the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the United Arab Emirates has made great effort to expand its military operations in countries that surround the strait. The most important bases of the UAE's army include the island of Socotra and several naval bases in the port cities of Aden and Mocha in southern Yemen, two military bases in Somalia, and one base in Eritrea and Djibouti, and efforts to establish a presence on the coast of Sudan. The Emiratis made great efforts to achieve complete military dominance over this strategic waterway by dominating the ports of southern Yemen and the islands of Socotra and Mayoun. However, Ansarullah's resistance and heavy attacks on UAE interests in this area have prevented Abu Dhabi from fully realizing this goal. Abu Dhabi's partner, and in some cases, long-standing rival in this regard, is Saudi Arabia, which has been developing its naval fleet centered on the port of Jeddah for several years due to its long coastline on the Red Sea. And on the other hand, it also has military presence in Djibouti alongside some regional and supra-regional powers. For the Saudi rulers, dominating the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab was a way to escape the geopolitical deadlock and excessive dependence on the Strait of Hormuz, but to this day, they have not succeeded in doing so, and all three of their maritime access routes, namely the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Suez Canal, are controlled by their rival powers. Turkey, which has been pursuing its strategic development plans from the Caucasus to North Africa since Erdogan's rule, is one of the new powers that has been trying to establish an active military presence in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandab Strait in recent years. The Turkish army currently has military bases in Somalia and Sudan. Several European countries, including Britain, France, and Spain, have also increased their activities in the Red Sea region over the past decade, centered on the French military base in Djibouti. Over time, other European Union countries have also joined the French base, as 70% of the EU's imports pass through the Red Sea.
Djibouti is very important. We use it, as you noted, as a base. Mm-hmm. Others, friends and others, use it as a base as well. Mm-hmm. It's important because we also base other kinds of maritime reconnaissance aircraft there.
Djibouti's strategic location in the Horn of Africa has led two East Asian players to establish military bases in the country. One of these two countries is Japan, which has been establishing a permanent military base in Djibouti since 2011. This is the first military base away from home that Japan has established since the Second World War. With China's increasing power in global trade and the rapid development of its naval fleet, the Chinese also established their base in Djibouti in 2016. thanks to its heavy investment in the African continent and to protect its commercial interests, especially based on the One Belt, One Road mega project, China has a great need to maintain the security of the Red Sea region, and this requires a permanent military presence, especially a port capable of receiving heavy naval vessels of the country's navy. Although the Zionist regime has a very narrow coastline in the Gulf of Aqaba on the way to the Red Sea, in the past decades, they've tried to expand their strategic depth of access to the sea from the southern part of the occupied territories by expanding their military and security presence on the islands of the southern Red Sea, such as Dahlak and Perim, as well as a secret spy and telecommunications interception base at Mount Embo Soira in the Eritrean territory.
The Houthis have achieved something, if nothing more than they've caused everyone to recognize the fact that they can, in fact, impact a very strategic area with almost nothing.
The Zionists have long sought to control the Mediterranean-Red Sea maritime trade route in order to secure common interests with Western countries. The big Suez Canal crisis in 1956, with the joint attack of Israel, France, and Britain to regain control of the canal, and the big Yom Kippur War of 1973 with the Egyptian and Syrian armies, were among the important steps taken by the Zionist regime in this direction. Finally, the largest military presence among foreign countries, as expected, is that of the United States, which, thanks to its largest military base in Djibouti and the pretext of fighting Somali pirates, has deployed a large number of its vessels at sea and its aircraft and combat forces in African countries bordering the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden for two decades.
The Houthis shut down maritime traffic in the Red Sea. The United States declares Operation Prosperity Guardian. We're going, United States is going, we're going to carrier task force, we got destroyers, we got cruisers, we got NATO partners. By God, Houthis, watch out now. Here we come. And what happened? Carrier task force group is pulled out. Yeah, still got some destroyers there. And who has shut down the Red Sea? The Houthis. Can't stop the Houthis.
But despite the fierce competition between various world powers for military presence in the countries of the Horn of Africa and the outskirts of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, without dominating the coasts of Yemen or at least establishing a partnership with the ruling power in this country and ensuring the security of the sea route north and south of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, all the aforementioned efforts for military presence in the Red Sea will almost be fruitless. This bitter truth was well understood by Western countries, and especially the Zionist entity, in the events that occurred over the past year.
They said explicitly and repeatedly that that was in defense of the Palestinian people who were being attacked by Israel.
The Yemeni people have been under colonial rule and domination by powers such as the Ottomans, Britain, the Soviet Union, the United States, and Saudi Arabia for over 100 years. But thanks to the emergence of the Ansarullah movement and its control over the capital and the western coasts of Yemen, it is now the will and decision of the Yemenis that determines safe passage through the Bab el-Mandab Strait. Any country whose actions are against the interests of the Yemeni people and the member states of the Axis of Resistance will not be allowed to safely transit its ships through the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab Strait.
When it comes to the Houthis, yes, they have ballistic missiles, and that is a significant capability.
On October 7th, 2023, the Palestinian Resistance Movement carried out Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, inflicting the greatest military security shock on the Zionist entity since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. The extremely high volume of Israeli casualties and captives transferred to the Gaza Strip had devastating effects on the Zionist regime militarily and socially. The Zionists carried out brutal bombing and major crimes against the oppressed Palestinian people in a different way than in previous battles, and this caused other resistance groups in the region to come to the aid of the Palestinian fighters in the Gaza Strip. Despite the distance of more than 1,800 kilometers to the occupied territories, the Yemeni army and popular forces demonstrated a very active and uninterrupted participation in supporting the Palestinian cause and the resistance. Given their access to the West Coast and very convenient access to the center and south of the Red Sea, the Yemeni Ansarullah had the ability to attack the south of occupied territories, while at the same time having a relatively large arsenal of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and suicide drones, and played a special role in pressuring the Zionist regime. The first attacks by the Yemeni Ansarullah movement began on October 19, 2023, which was a combined attack with cruise missiles, attacks on ground targets, and suicide drones. Without U.S. military assistance, the Israeli military was unable to cover the south of the occupied territories because it was simultaneously busy attacking the Gaza Strip and fighting with the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah on the northern front.
I think it's really quite shameful that the administration is likely waiting until soldiers or sailors get killed in this. I mean, the idea of having a military is to deter. And when your adversary is escalating, then you have to take action to deter them from further escalation. And that is what we have failed to do here.
Therefore, from the very beginning of the Yemeni army's attacks on the port of Eilat, the U.S. Navy took direct action to defend the Zionist regime, for instance, claiming it had shot down 4 cruise missiles and 15 Yemeni drones on the same day. However, the volume of Yemeni army attacks on the south of the occupied territories and commercial ships affiliated with the Zionist entity in the Red Sea gradually increased, and the Americans were no longer able to counter these attacks alone. On December 18, 2023, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the formation of an international naval coalition to counter the Ansarullah's attacks, dubbed Operation Prosperity Guardian.
Regarding the Houthis, these attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law. And so we're taking action to build an international coalition to address this threat.
The coalition was formed with more than 20 members, but only the United States, the UK, Germany, Denmark, and Sri Lanka had warships in the conflict zone.
It's clear that this type of behavior can't be met without a response. We need to send a strong signal that this breach of international law is wrong. People can't act like this with impunity, and that's why, together with allies, we've decided to take this action.
The European countries of France, Italy, and Spain, along with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, refused to join the coalition and announced that they will independently escort commercial ships and counter Ansarullah missile and drone attacks. Also, according to many security and media sources, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have helped the Zionist regime to initially detect missiles and drones fired from Yemen into occupied territories and even in some cases intercepted and destroyed them. In January of 2024, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2722 condemning the Ansarullah attacks in the Red Sea. Although one of the main points of this resolution was the efforts of all parties to the conflict to reduce the level of tension in the region, the United States and Britain abuse the resolution and launch illegal airstrikes on Yemeni territory.
The U.S. says tonight that it is not interested in a war with Yemen, just hours after American and British missiles hit Houthi rebel positions there.
A massive naval and air campaign against the Yemeni army, an army that had been engaged in internal conflict with the Saudi and Emirati armies and their mercenaries for years, and now it was ready to fight a coalition with a strong leadership that had never been defeated in international waters. Although many countries were trying to escort ships and ensure their safety as they passed through the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the sum of all their assets combined was not as much as that of the United States. The U.S. Navy has at various times deployed two aircraft carrier groups with maximum possible operational capacity in the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea, the aircraft carrier the Eisenhower and the amphibious assault ship the Bataan. Each of these two groups also included several destroyers, support ships, and nuclear submarines, the most famous of which were the destroyers the Mason, the Kearney, and Laboon of the Arleigh Burke class, which recorded the most experience of engaging with missiles and drones fired from Yemen. The U.S. aircraft carriers are equipped with advanced F-35, F-18, and Harrier, as well as Poseidon Maritime Patrol and E-2 Hawkeye aircraft.
So what I saw there, you know, during my time as the Maritime Operations Center Director, the Houthis are not launching these one at a time. They're launching them in swarms. And then shortly behind the UAV would be a cruise missile. Or a ballistic missile, and I call them ballistic missiles, but we have to understand what's happening in the theater. They're not flying a ballistic trajectory. They're not going exo-atmospheric. Mm. It's the speed associated with it, but the Houthis have depressed the trajectory, and these missiles are getting out to the battle space fairly quickly. If a ballistic missile is fired from the typical launching points that we've seen, the ships have anywhere from 15 to 20 seconds.
While each escort destroyer carries more than 100 defensive missiles to counter attacks by the Yemeni army or Tomahawk cruise missiles to attack deep inside Yemeni territory, dozens of MQ-9 Reaper drones also conduct reconnaissance flights from nearby bases over Yemeni territory or Red Sea waters. According to the direct admission of the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Naval Forces in the region, the U.S. Navy has never experienced such a combat formation for such a long time since World War II.
How many sailors are now in the Red Sea?
Yeah, we've got about 7,000 right now. So it's a large commitment.
When was the last time that the U.S. Navy operated at this pace for a couple months?
I think you'd have to go back to World War II, where you have ships who are engaged in combat. When I say engaged in combat, where they're getting shot at, we're getting shot at, and we're shooting back.
This is while large numbers of ships from European countries and the Royal Air Force's Eurofighter Typhoon fighter jets are also engaged in escorting commercial ships and carrying out attacks on Yemeni territory.
The Houthis are the first entity in the history of the world to use anti-ship ballistic missiles ever firing against shipping.
No one has ever used
an anti-ship ballistic missile, certainly against commercial shipping, much less against U.S. Navy ships. If there is an anti-ship ballistic missile launch, this ballistic missile travels at about Mach 5, about 3,000 miles an hour.
How much time is there between a Houthi launch and then it could reach a U.S. ship?
If it's coming toward them, now just put yourself in the seat of the destroyer captain on that ship. He has about 9 to 15 seconds to make a decision that they're going to shoot that down. It's intense.
The U.S. military has also made extensive use of its military bases in West Asia to direct attacks against Yemen.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Donishman. Please stay tuned. We must observe justice in our life, especially when facing our family members. Some men get angry at their wives and they completely forget their kindness. This is not welcomed in the religion of Islam at all. This is the same woman who tolerated all the burdens in life and did not complain about her poor conditions. You as a man must not get angry at her. And even if you are angry, you must be kind to your wife. Why the people close their eyes and open their mouths when they become angry? The woman must also be thankful to their man. They must be thankful for all the hardships that their men bear in life. We, in Islam, are not allowed to belittle each other. Also, we must not degrade each other's kindness. Therefore, observing justice in our marital life is one of the keys to having a successful and prosperous married life. Being kind to each other means to be thankful to each other, even for the smallest efforts that are made in life. Kindness and justice are the ways to be happy in married life for both men and women. Thank you very much, dear listeners of Arab English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Donishman. To find more about this program and our other programs, please visit our new website at iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
iranradio.ir. What you just heard was an Arabi English radio program.
In the limelight.
Five centuries of Western domination of the world is coming to an end. This will be the century of Asia, Eurasia, and Africa. India should strategize accordingly. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "To be an enemy of America can be dangerous, but to be a friend is fatal." These are purportedly the words of Henry Kissinger, the notorious war criminal and Nobel Peace Prize winner who greatly influenced American foreign policy. India must not forget this dark side of the American establishment, even though Joe Biden claimed that U.S.-India relations are the most consequential of this century. And Donald Trump has repeatedly met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, calling him a great leader. The U.S. pivot to India is undergirded by three American interests: containment of China, cheap labor, and a vast consumer market. The United States has no real allies, only narcissistic and imperialist interests. Modi was one of the few foreign leaders invited to the White House during the first month of Trump's new administration. Overall, Indians also have very positive opinions about Trump and the United States in general. There are many reasons why the United States enjoys significant soft power in India: immigration, tech jobs, the success of Indian Americans, the popularity of the English language, Western funding of Indian think tanks, American investors in Indian corporate media, tensions with China, and so on. However, India, a rising global power, must be careful not to turn into the Ukraine of Asia, an expendable geopolitical pawn of the United States empire. Let us be blunt. The U.S. wants to control every aspect of India. A few months ago, the U.S. ambassador to India told an Indian audience that there is no such thing as a strategic autonomy. Ominously, this warning came just before the U.S. staged the color revolution in Bangladesh and overthrew Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina Wajid, who was not perfect but had done a commendable job in reviving the economy. The reason was simple. PM Hasina refused to allow a U.S. military base in her country. Similarly, any objective geopolitical analyst could see how the U.S. staged coups in Pakistan and Sri Lanka in the past few days. Incarcerated Prime Minister Imran Khan was ousted by a soft coup after blatant U.S. pressure. His party was banned and he was sent to prison. How about that for American-style freedom and democracy? His crime was to be too friendly to Russia. As for Sri Lanka, the party in power was deemed to be too pro-China. Of course, the United States could not allow such independence. History also reveals that the United States was never a true ally of India. While the Indian foreign policy establishment is wary of China's influence in India's neighborhood, there is almost no outcry about American meddling in India's sphere of influence. Indians are too forgiving about the fact that in 1966, the U.S. CIA luckily assassinated Indian Prime Minister Lal Bahadur Shastri and the top nuclear scientist Homi Bhabha. All through the Cold War, the United States sabotaged India as a punishment for the latter's non-alignment philosophy and friendly relations with the USSR. The United States also encouraged India to start a war with China over Tibet, but then-President JFK refused to provide any military assistance at this critical moment. Later, when Bangladesh sought independence, the United States sent warships to the Bay of Bengal to threaten India, which was able to repel the Americans only with the help of the Soviet Union. Fast forward to today, India has not really benefited from its close relations with America. When the Cold War ended, American corporations salivated over China and India to be exploited for cheap labor in manufacturing and services, respectively. However, the difference in these two countries could not be starker. While China focused on mastering technologies and creating indigenous champions, Indian elites were content with using American products. The result could be seen in Chinese tech giants such as Huawei, BYD, ByteDance, and 135 other companies in the Fortune 500 list, compared to just 9 from India. In artificial intelligence, the most disruptive technology of this century, China owns 60% of the patents, while India accounts for less than 1%. In numerous other industries, including electric cars, solar panels, batteries, smartphones, semiconductors, robotics, cloud computing, biotech, space travel, fighter jets, warships, etc., China has far surpassed India. Why has India fallen behind? Because we follow the American economic model of financialized capitalism and we feel safe with dependency on the American dollar, American technology, American media, American medicine, American investment, and so on. India also allows its foreign policy to be dictated by the United States more than necessary. For example, we could be buying cheap oil and gas from Iran, and we could have started the Chabahar port project a long time ago. However, India is too differential towards U.S. sanctions. Similarly, India joining the Quad and other Indo-Pacific agreements to contain China or refusing to join the Belt and Road Initiative only promotes the U.S. geopolitical machinations of divide and rule. Right now, the U.S. benefits from India in multiple ways, relatively inexpensive Indian labor in the software industry, ultra-cheap manufacturing labor for companies like Apple, a giant consumer market of growing middle class, Indian startups being open to American investors, Indian government's purchase of U.S. weapons, and India being a potential geopolitical tool to contain China diplomatically, economically, and militarily. However, American soft power will not last long in India. First, the United States will soon restrict immigration from India, especially for H-1B tech workers. The racist American alt-right has already started demonizing Indians. Second, the United States will start containing India as the latter continues to grow and become more independent. The United States may allow Indians to become CEOs of Google and Microsoft, but the U.S. will not tolerate Indian companies that compete with Google and Microsoft. The U.S. maintains its global hegemony not because of equal partners, but through a network of vassals. Even Europeans are finally waking up from their hypernotic slumber. The new German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, said that Europe must work towards independence from the United States. Looking at the big picture, we are witnessing the cycle of history in which another empire is on the verge of collapse. However, unlike the last few centuries, the United States will not be replaced by another empire. Instead, a multipolar world is emerging to democratize geopolitics and geoeconomy. Organizations like BRICS will provide a new paradigm of cooperation and development for the Global South nations. Also gone will be the extraordinary privilege of the US dollar, which underpins American tyranny of sanctions and endless wars. 5 centuries of Western domination of the world is coming to an end. This will be the century of Asia, Eurasia, and Africa. India should strategize accordingly.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, as always. Salaam alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are around Eid al-Fitr, the end of the month of Ramadan and the beginning of Shawwal. So let me extend my felicitations and congratulations and happy Eid in advance to all of the Muslim Ummah, wherever they are. Well, let's focus on some of the jurisprudential laws related to Eid and moonsighting, Sheikh,
right,
in this episode. And let me start this episode with this question. What are the rules of Eid prayers? Because we know that Muslims rush to the mosque, and when the time comes, actually, early morning, they offer the Eid prayers.
Well, first of all, I would like to congratulate the Muslim Ummah and those who listen to us on this auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr. When it comes to your question, I would say that, of course, we have two scenarios. One scenario is the scenario in which the Imam is present. If the Imam is present, of course, Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha prayers are obligatory for all Muslims who are qualified, who are adult, and it is necessary for them to offer the Eid prayer in congregation, in Jama'ah, of course. But during the present time, of course, when the Holy Imam is in the major occultation, these prayers are mustahab. Mustahab means that they are recommended to offer, to be offered by Muslims. And of course, if a person, because of some reasons, failed to offer those prayers, he is not to blame. And of course, these the prayer of Eid, whether it is Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Adha, can be performed individually, or and it can be performed in this time around, it can be performed in congregation. Now, if, for example, a person is very far from the place where the Eid prayer is performed, so he can just he can make wudu and of course perform the Eid prayer in his house without having to cover a long distance and offer those prayers with Jama'ah. Of course, it's much better to go to the Jama'ah, and of course you will see a lot of friends, you hug them, you congratulate them on this auspicious day, and it's a kind of silah rahim, keeping ties with them.
Yes.
But if that's not possible, you can offer the prayer individually.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that, of course, that when it comes to the time of the prayer, it's a big question for many people.
Yes, what is the most proper time for offering the
The time of Eid prayer is from sunrise till midday, okay? Mm-hmm. It can be offered anytime during this time. And, of course, it's mustahab that Eid al-Adha prayers is offered after sunrise, of course. And as for Eid al-Fitr, it is mustahab that one should have a breakfast after sunrise, pay Zakat al-Fitr, and then offer Eid al-Prayer. Because when you wake up, you are still fasting. You're not sure whether it's the day of Eid or not. But you are actually, it's good that it's recommended that you eat breakfast and then give your Zakat al-Fitr. And then, of course, wear your nice and beautiful clothes. And then, of course, before that, you will take a shower and then prepare yourself for the Eid day.
Yes.
And that's
there's a recommended ghusl
of course,
for it.
Yes. Now then, when it comes to Eid prayer, if you are going to offer the Eid prayer individually, of course, Eid prayer consists of two rakahs, okay?
Mm.
With five qurud in the first rakah, first of all, you will make the niyyah and then takbiratul ihram, then recite hamd, and then the surah ikhlas.
Yes.
And then there are five qunut in the first rakah, five qunut. During the qunut, there is a special recommended dua, but if you cannot memorize it or if you cannot read it from the paper, you can recite Subhanallah.
Yes.
That's enough. And it's not necessary to recite that
right,
long
to memorize
zikr.
It, yeah.
Yes, and of course, even if you memorize it, you will forget it later because you offer the Eid prayer only twice in a year if you happen to.
Right.
Then in the second rakat, of course, you will do the same. You will recite Hamd in Surah,
right.
And then there are four qunut which will be performed or done after the Ikhlas or the Surah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Sheikh Javid, our guest and speaker, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related actually to the end of the month of Ramadan and the beginning of Shawwal, I mean, Eid prayers and moon sighting. And regarding moon sighting, Sheikh Javid, is the sighting of the new crescent through, let's say, or using binoculars, telescope, and the like, permissible and sufficient?
Well, that's a very important question, I think, because there are a lot of Muslims who want to just make sure that the crescent has been sighted. Now, they just wonder as to whether it's sufficient to see, to sight, or establish this moon with by just seeing it with a telescope, with equipped eye or not. Of course, the scholars are divided in this regard. Let's say some of the scholars are of the view that, okay, we should find the moon in the sky with our naked eyes, and some are of the view that no, we can use it. We can use any tools or means to just find the moon in the sky, in the horizon, And it doesn't make any difference whether, okay, we see it with our naked eyes or with some thing like binoculars or telescope or something. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, may Allah grant him long life, he's of the view that the sighting of the new crescent with these instruments mentioned in your question, of course, is also okay. It's reliable and its ruling does not differ from that of the naked eye at mm-hmm. all, mm-hmm. Because the standard is to say it has been seen by mm-hmm. by eyes, mm-hmm. okay, and of course it is seen by the eyes, but there are some tools okay used to see it, but citing the computerized photograph of the crescent moon or the like, which cannot be clearly categorized
yes.
as sighting, is problematic to be approved for new month.
Okay, thank yes. you very much, Javid. Let's take a break and then we'll be back and continue program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the end of the month of Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, and Eid prayers and moon sighting, of course, of the following month of Shawwal. I mean, well, regarding the moon sighting, you know, marking the beginning of Shawwal, Sheikh Javid, if that is not happening, I mean, it's not being observed, for example, in one city by the local people, but they hear the television programs or radio ones, actually, they announce the beginning of Shawwal the next month after Ramadan, right?
Right.
Should the local people act upon the radio announcement or the television programs, or should they ascertain by investigating whether Shawwal has commenced?
Right. That's a big, very important question, but I should say that it differs from one country to another, from one situation to another. It depends where you live.
Mm.
If the radio or television announcement makes them sure or confident that Shawwal has commenced, let's say, or there is a decree, a fatwa by the Wali Faqih, for example, or Jewish yeah. leader, announcing the beginning of the of the month of Shawwal, there is no need for further investigation. So, because they rely on the radio, and the radio belongs to a government, to a state ruled by a Wali Faqih, there is no problem. The Muqallid can simply rely on the announcement and go ahead with celebrating Eid. But if, for example, let's say, if a Shia Muslim lives in a predominantly populated Sunni country, like there are Shia Muslims living in Saudi Arabia, in UAE or Qatar, and of course, as we see, they announce the Eid day sometimes, I'm not saying that they always do this, sometimes they announce the Eid day one day before the other countries like India, like Pakistan, like Iran, and many other countries. So they cannot, the announcement made by those countries is not reliable.
Mm-hmm.
They have to consult they have to check with the websites of their religious authorities. They have to make a phone call to the offices of the marja they follow to make sure whether they have to observe fast the next day or not, or mm-hmm. they have to celebrate Eid or not. Of course, they cannot follow the majority, for example, Sunni Muslims, in terms of breaking their fast or celebrating Eid. They have to see whether they have to make sure whether the moon, for example, has been sighted or not. If it has not been sighted and no one claims to have seen that, the moon, then they cannot break their fast.
I see. Well, very quick question again. If it is difficult to ascertain the beginning of the month of Ramadan or Eid al-Fitr,
right,
meaning Shawwal, because of inability to observe the crescent at the beginning of the month due to the clouds, for example, or
right.
any other reasons, and or if the count of the month of Shawwal or the month of Ramadan did not add up to 30 days,
Yes.
Is it permissible for us to, in another country, a non-Muslim country like Japan, to go by the horizon in a Muslim country such as Iran, or should we rely on the regular calendar? What's the rule?
Well, if the first of a month is not evidenced, let's say fasting is not, let's say it's the first of Ramadan, it's not evidenced by anything. Fasting is not obligatory for someone like him. But if it is evidenced later that this day was the first of Ramadan or maybe the first of Shawwal, he has to act accordingly, you see. If it was the first day of Ramadan, then he has to make up for that day. He should give the qadha of that day.
I see.
And while if the new crescent of Shawwal, for example, has not been ascertained, even by being sighted in an adjacent city which is united in horizon with one's own city, on the evidence of two just witnesses or on the basis of the decree by the Hakim Shar, it is obligatory to fast on that day, for example.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hamas calls for international investigations into Israel's targeting of medical teams in Gaza as the regime admits firing on ambulances in the Palestinian territory. The United States conducts new deadly airstrikes on several areas in Yemen, including the capital Sana'a. And the death toll from the Nigerian forces attack on Quds Day protesters in Abuja has risen to 19, with dozens more injured. Welcome to the program. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, has strongly condemned the targeting of medical teams by Israeli forces in Gaza, calling for international investigations. Hamas has said, after days of losing contact with